We're ready. Okay. All right, I'm Laurie Summers. I'm here with Harley Langdale Jr., and this is the third in a series of interviews about his gift of memorabilia, the Harley Langdale Jr. Collection, to Valdosta State University. It's June 30th, 2003. And the first item I'd like to talk about is this framed photograph of you and President Carter. It's ID number 95, and we just need some information, if anything you can tell us about when this was taken or how you got this particular photograph. Where?
That picture was taken in Atlanta, Georgia at the famous Methodist Church, and that was at D.W. Brooks's, who had passed away, memorial. Like, he was the one, Dr. Brooks is the one that started Gold Kiss, which was a farmer's organization, and he had been retired for several years and passed away when he was in his 90s. And at that time, I saw the past governor, Jimmy Carter, and he came by and we asked him, talked to him. And I had met him before. I had met him when he was governor of Georgia. And I introduced him at the Georgia Forestry Association at one time. And I introduced him in such a way, I said, I'm happy to have a real farmer as president, as now governor, and so we can sit down and talk about our problems of forest management. And so I saw him there, and Dr. Brooks's grandson took the picture and gave me a copy of it.
Do you have any sense, we can look up when that funeral was, but do you have any idea sort of about what year this would have been taken?
Well, yeah, I would say that it was about... My best guess would be about 1995.
Okay.
In the Methodist Church that Dr. Brooks had been a member of.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Anything else you want to add about that? We just basically needed an ID.
Well, I was very glad to see him, and I saw some of my other friends there, because Dr. Brooks had been a very famous, successful manager of keeping the Gold Kiss handled by the cooperative at that time. And now part of it has been sold to Southern States Cooperative. Headquartered in Richmond, Virginia.
Is that spelled G-O-L-D-K-I-S-T? Goldkist.
Goldkist, G-O-L-D-K-I-S-T.
Okay. And were you a member of that?
Yes, we were members, and we traded with them at their stores with chemicals and fertilizers and other equipment that we used on our farms.
Okay.
And Dr. Brooks was a very ardent hunter, and he would come hunting, shooting quail at Kinderloo.
All right, well, that's our topic. We're gonna save time for mm-hmm. that one, I'm sure. Okay, I'm gonna do the next item. I guess I need to... We're going to have some shorter ones this time here. Whoops. This is, like I said, odds and ends here. Can we just proceed, Bill? Okay. So this is ID number 1, It's a miniature cotton bale from Southern States, Morven Cotton Gin. And there's this card on it. And you have a couple of these in the materials that you gave to the university. And we'd just like to get, was there a certain relationship between the Langdale Company and this particular business? Or just tell me, can you tell me anything about this? There were two of these. There was a smaller one, too, that...
Well, we farm some of our land that we do not grow trees on because we put it to the best use, and we think that that's the best thing to do. So that was from Southern States, and some of the we usually had our cotton ginned at in Marvin, and I think that came from Marvin, but now
right.
Southern States, after they bought part of Gold Kiss, had several cotton gins.
This card says Marvin. It says Anthony Steve Bullard,
uh-huh.
Crop Advisor Marvin.
Yeah. That came from, and that's just a little memento that they gave us because we were cotton farmers, and we've been cotton farmers every year.
So throughout your memory, the Langdale family has used land for cash crops, cotton and other crops, or
and other crops. We grew cotton and tobacco and corn and soybeans and milo and then a few other crops. But that was our major crops.
So all of these, as you say, was to use the land to its best advantage.
But we thought that was the best use for the particular piece of land.
And then you would sell the crops and reinvest the proceeds, or what?
Yeah, we would sell the crops and divide that with our farmers that was producing, and that was their livelihood too. But they were really there, and they could do, if we had forest fires, they would help. And we like to have those kind of dedicated people that were farming, and they did help us if we did have they knew what was going on the surrounding properties.
So are the farmers are they renting land from the company? Are they employees of the company?
The way we did was on a partnership basis, and most of our farmers would make some money, not necessarily a lot, but they made money. And we work with them on a partnership basis.
Okay. All right. Get the next one here. This is ID number 70. It's an etched glass plaque mounted in a pine base, inscribed Langdale, 100 years, and that's your company logo, right, on there?
Yes.
And then 1894 to 1994. Now, we were talking about this before, and has anything come to you about who gave you this? You said you...
I don't really know where that came from, but that's some that we received during that year that we were celebrating our 100th anniversary, which was 1994.
Tell me a little bit about that benchmark, that landmark in the company. How did the company celebrate or mark its 100th year?
We had a lot of our customers that would congratulating us on being in business, and some of them had done business with us so long, and they were they gave us all kind of things such as this, and so we were glad to celebrate, and I think that our employees appreciated it too.
Did the company itself do anything to commemorate
Well, we had several gatherings, and our favorite is when we do for all of our employees have a hamburger dinner at what we call our boneyard. That's where we have some tables and some places to sit down, and we take hamburgers or hot dogs and slaw and other things that go with it. And so we let them all know that we've been in business that long, and I think everybody appreciated that.
Now, the boneyard is located where, though?
Well, close to the plant, because we call the boneyard some of our outdated equipment, or some of our equipment that for some reason or another we have retired and bought other better equipment, usually labor-saving equipment, and more electronic and things like that to upgrade our operation, which our employees and customers appreciate.
Is that a place where, if you have events for employees, that's where it has taken place in the past, the boneyard, or was that just a one-time thing?
Oh no, we keep it there. It's on one corner of our property, and it's not too far from where all that equipment is there, because we want to keep some of that old equipment, because we never know when it's got just the right part that we're looking for that we couldn't find anywhere else.
But you said you had this hamburger dinner for your employees there.
Yes.
Was that the first time you'd had an event in that location?
Oh no. No, I think we have used it before, but we use it frequently, especially when times are such that we are making a little bit of money. We try to slow down on things like that when price is declining and maybe we're not making any money. But we do have it when we're progressing along very good in our market, all right.
Now, you said that a number of your business partners would give you these things during that year.
They'd give us pens and things like that, just little things, nothing that costs a lot of money.
I was wondering whether the company itself produced something to
We put out a paper, a magazine type deal, and showed some of the pictures from further back and grandfather and what they did and pictures that we had saved through the years, and gave to everybody that wanted one.
Do you still have copies of those?
I'm not sure. We've got a man, Jim Hickman, that does that. And he's getting ready for a interim sort of get about that and what we're going to do.
That would be a nice, if there are some of those pieces, it would be a nice thing to add to your collection. Just as a hint for the archive here, just something about the company to kind of go with.
I really don't know how far progressed we are with that.
Had any extras from 1994.
Jim Hickman would be the man, and I'll check with him about it and see if he's got any of the extras.
Okay.
We should have saved more, I know, and we may have some of those.
You mentioned the one celebration for the employees. Is there anything else that comes to mind about what the company did?
Well, sometimes on July the 4th or Labor Day or something, we'll have a dinner and let them bring their wives and children to it and let them just see on a weekend maybe. And we like to do that if our business is running in a condition that we're making a profit.
Right. I meant for the centennial. Was there anything in particular that the
company
did?
No, I don't know of anything. I don't know anything that strong at that point.
And I just was curious, just for comparison, I may be getting, 1994. You would have been in the position to remember if there was anything done for a 50th anniversary in the company.
We did not do anything for a 50th anniversary. And in other words, we had not done anything for any previous day like that.
Well.
And we're getting more and more public-minded and rather before in the turpentine business, it was very hard business and we worked and tried to pay our debts.
Okay. Okay. Bring over a couple things this time. Okay, and we have this carved wooden owl, which is ID number 110, with a plaque inscribed Georgia Forestry Association Wise Owl Award presented to Harley Langdell Jr. for outstanding service to Georgia Forestry, June 24th, 1996. Tell me a little bit first, do you remember the occasion in which you
received
this?
I remember it very well, and it was over at St. Simon's Island, out from Brunswick, and they had given one or two of those away over the past years, and I received this, and it was quite an honor that I appreciated very much. Mm-hmm. But it was from activity that they do to people that are spending time on activities to promote forestry and new ways of doing things and just being helpful with the Georgia Forestry Association even after our term as president and chairman and such.
And you were chairman of?
I was president and then retired, and then other times that I've done other things for the Georgia Forestry Association.
Mm-hmm. And can you speak a little bit just about some of the things that might come to mind about your role and what you feel you were able to do during your association with the Georgia Forestry Association?
We've been members of the Georgia Forestry Association for a good many years. And I would say that the Georgia Forestry Association in the beginning was a group of people together to try to do something about the legislative rules and regulations and laws. And as I came along, we were doing more from what we learned in school, and we were more technically inclined people, and we got together to pass along knowledge that we knew and what we could do about wild forest fires or other things about forestry, and so people would recognize it. And another thing that worried us all was the ad valorem taxes that we had to pay on trees and land that you weren't able to get an income every year to pay those taxes. And we're still working on that too. And it seems like we're paying more and more taxes. But forestry is the biggest business in the state of Georgia. And volume, and it's very, Georgia has made a lot of progress. And I was always happy to go to other states and have the opportunity to talk with people there and tell them how much progress Georgia had been making under our governors and our legislature. So that was all. We wanted to promote forestry methods every way that we could, so we could make products that would make them more profitable.
Was there anything particular about the Georgia Forestry Association as opposed to the commission and other kinds of things that you were involved in? Is this the one that deals more with legislation, or anything particular about that organization that comes to mind?
Well, we cover the state so well, forest people, and every county hold all the 169 counties, and we get together to try to get things done. And under Herman Talmadge's regime, which when they had statewide fire protection, we were very happy to have that, because there were some counties that just wasn't in a financial position that they could help financially. And so things like that, that we tried to work together on, which I think it was it's an association that we belonged to all through these years, and that I think is one that's been worthwhile. And it seems to me like it's getting better, and we're now having a major headquarters are being built in Forsyth, Georgia, which is sort of in the middle of the state, and I look forward, and my great-nephew is very active in it.
Which one is that?
Wesley Langdale, John W. Langdale III.
That's a venerable Langdale name, isn't
yeah.
it? Do you know anything about the...
Carving?
Yes.
No, I really didn't. They presented that to me, and I really have not had who did it or explain it to me how I did it and what kind of wood that is.
It's cypress, and the...
It says what?
It's cypress, and the artist C.M. Copeland was has passed away within, I think, the last few years now, but he lived in Fitzgerald, and he did a number of these kind of pieces, and I have a pileated woodpecker that he did. I mean, he did all kinds of things, but he did a number of...
Very beautiful done.
You can feel it's very light for its size, because it's cypress, and his pieces would really, you know, take advantage of the grain of cypress.
Very nice.
So, okay, I'm gonna just put that down. You had a number of plaques that you have in your memorabilia. This is, we just picked this one out. It's ID 34. And this was given to you in celebration of your 80th birthday by the employees of the Langdale Forest Products Company. And I just wonder if you remember anything about this particular occasion.
Well, I have received a good many awards like that through the years. And we've tried to stay very close to our employees, and we get to know them better, and it's a little bit different, and I appreciate receiving that from them. But we have, most of our employees stay with us until they retire. And although sometimes they might think that our benefits or our wages might not be as great as some of them, we do have more relations with them than most manufacturers.
Do you recall anything about the occasion in which you received that?
Not unusual. Not unusual, I don't.
But was there a dinner or a presentation or anything that you remember?
No, just when they all got together like at the Boneyard, and they presented that. And some of the groups would get together, and they would do things like that.
So I just wondered if you're only 80 years old once, so that was this, you don't recall if this was on your birthday itself, or there was a party the employees gave you, or anything like that when you turned 80, or this was just presented to you at some point?
No, I really don't remember anything exceptional at that time.
Okay. All right. So now we're going to go to the a topic that I know you can talk quite a bit about here. Let me just get this one small cup and lots of... Let's put this up too. We're going to start with this silver cup. This is ID number 94, and it's a silver cup with a copper-silver label with an image of a quail, labeled Georgia-Florida Field Trial Club, 1916 to 1991. And then there are these two different books from different years with that are the Georgia-Florida Field Trial Club also. And I wanted to save a little time for this because I know from talking to you that your dogs are a big part of your life, at least certainly an important hobby. And why don't you just tell me a little bit about the property where you yourself do much of the hunting and are involved in these. Is your property Kinderloo your own property, or does this kind of...
We have family-wise, from my grandfather and my father, and then me coming along, we've always loved dogs, sometimes different dogs. Our grandfather liked hound dogs because he used them for catching hogs and then also to trail deer. And so you'd not about had to have dogs down in his area. But my father developed that instinct and enjoyed it, and he loved dogs. And when we lived in the middle of Valdosta, he always kept a dog there at the house, because when he wanted to go hunting, you had to have a bird dog. But we were just bird dog hunters. And so I grew up with that in mind, and I went with my father from the time I was 10 years old and older, and I would follow behind him, and that was my wishes to go right ahead and do better and better. So when we did get hold of the land at what is known as Kinderloo, that was a longleaf pine, it was wiregrass, and it was good quail land, and we planted feed, and then we had traps out for the varmints that would break up the quail nests and catch the young quail, and we did everything to have more quail. So We had a nice place, and
when did you acquire that land,
ma'am?
When did you acquire that land?
We acquired some land, I would say, in the early 40s, roundabout. But we acquired the land at what is known as out at Kinderloo. From Taylor Colquitt Company from Spartanburg, South Carolina, in 1947, and that was our main quail hunting area because it was longleaf wiregrass land, and that leaned itself to be in the proper place to have bird feed and plant bicolor lespedeza and other feeds that would attract quail. So we were very proud of it, and we used it to take our friends quail hunting. And we had limits, we didn't overshoot, and we didn't put any quail out at that time. we grew the quail, and it was quite a place to go hunting and shoot quail. So we've still been doing that up until a few years ago till it gets more difficult. We belong to the association there, which is the Georgia-Florida Field Trial Association, with headquarters in Thomasville, Georgia. We were the most eastern member, and it mostly was the Red Hills down between Thomasville and Tallahassee, and even some people a little further north. But my father had tried to win the field trial, and our friends that we had wanted to win the field trial. That was quite an undertaking, and we never have been able to win. We'd always come in down that. So we had a dog that was very beautiful dog, liver and white, and we went over, and that was after my father had been in an automobile wreck and was not able to go for several years there, and I was sort of handling the dogs and keeping up with them. And I was so happy to win that day. And that was in 1970. And they gave us a big silver cup. We keep it 1 year. So we kept it 1 year and kept it polished. And they gave us this little cup in remembrance of the big cup that we had. So that's why we have that cup right there.
Well, for somebody, say someone who doesn't know anything about a field trial in a club, just explain, if you're telling someone who just wanted to know what this was all about, what takes place, and that day that you won, what is it that you actually did?
Just simply we start off hunting, and we have a hunt master, and they have timing, and we can run the dogs 30 minutes. And so we line up the dogs and have them there ready to go hunting on different places that are selected every year. And we have the audience or the crowd that are with the hunt. They're all on their horseback, or on wagons, or on jeeps, and following through the woods. And so we start our dogs off, and our dog handler has it. They blow the whistle, and the dog starts hunting. And so the hunt judges, and they watch the dogs, and they usually two dogs run at the same time. No, not any more than that. One belongs to one party, and the other one dog is somebody else, so we're running against them. So they'll have about 10 different field trials, just like that, with 30 minutes at a time, and then they have lunch for everybody. And then at the end of the day, they add up how many quail they found and how many the dogs did, and the judges come up with a selection of the best dog that found the most quail and handled them, and didn't make mistakes such as getting too close to the quail and flushed them. So you want them to be staunch, and then you want to go up there and the handler show his superior judgment of flushing them, and then they shoot up in the air. Never to kill the quail, but just let the dog know you shot. So it's a great pastime, and nice people, and they stay with it all day long, and then at the end of the day they announce who won, and so we won that in 1970, if my memory is correct. Mm-hmm. So we're proud of it. I never will forget my father in the next year knew our dog was so good, and he couldn't understand why we didn't win it the next year. But it's all kind of circumstances that enter into where you're hunting and where your dog selects to take in the route. And it's not as simple as it sounds, but it's a lot of fun.
Do you remember the name of this particular dog?
His name was Rex is his main name, but his name was a longer name, a registered name, and his liver and white pointer, English pointer. He was a very hard working dog, but very hard to control and handle. And so it happened the day that we won, we had a misty rain, and that possibly slowed him down a little bit.
Now you said he had a very good handler. Do you recall the name of the employee or the person you had working with the dog at that point, with Rex?
Who the dog handler was? Mm-hmm. His name was, he stayed with us about 6 years, and that's the nature, really. And Howell was his last name. Mm-hmm. And I can't, but he handled the dog very well, and that has a lot to do with it, mm-hmm. too.
So as the owner of the dog, what is that basically your role, or what role do you play?
That was our kennel. Mm-hmm. And see, we had the Langdale kennels, and we kept them up. And they were my father's and mine, and I guess the Langdale family. But it was, others didn't really quail hunt. We had brother next to me liked fish better than anything. And my younger brother liked to fish better than hunt, but that was my father and my pastime.
And you mentioned when you were a kid growing up, you were just, you know, hunting with a bird dog. So I presume you were not necessarily hunting quail.
We would hunt other game. We would hunt doves. And those days we would go on dove shoots and we'd pick up for my father when I was 10 years old. I got my first shotgun that he gave me on my birthday when I was 12 in 1926. And I never will forget, I went hunting in South Carolina with my father. We were invited to our friend's place at Palmetto Bluff, which is a very famous place right across the river in South Carolina, and I killed a deer. And I guess that went with me all my life, and that was about probably the happiest day I had certainly those days. But he believed in that, and he believed in his boys knowing how to handle the gun and safely, and he thought that was part of boys growing up, and I think he was right.
And when did you make the transition to the, you know, the field trials and the, you know, the quail hunting scene, which is a somewhat different scene than just going out in the woods and hunting with your father, right? This is a more of a formalized, social.
That's right. It was completely different. You're really right on that. But I would say that I always had other people to hunt with if I didn't go with my father, because he believed in us hunting. He thought we ought to be working, or going to school, or hunting, or fishing. He liked his boys, all of them, to be outdoors people, and to know about the woods and the fields. And I'm proud that I had that opportunity. So I would say that when we got to be in the 1930s on, we were 15, 16, 18 years old. We always tried to hunt. Even when I went off to college, we'd come home and we'd always want to go hunting. So we grew up that way. And so this was, and I never did like the field trial. It was enjoyable to begin with, but I didn't like to be going to field trials all the time. Some people went on field trials and then they dogs and they trafficked and traded with the dogs, but we never did do that.
Are you still involved in the field trials with Langdale dogs?
We do not really do that because because my father, when he passed away in 1972, we've slowed down on going to those field trials, and we'd lots rather have some of our friends and go out and have a little lunch and hunt and show them the merits of the dogs that we had.
What would have been the period then when you would have been involved more actively in the field trial club?
I would say the field trial clubs we started in the, early 60s, and then for about 20 years we went.
Right. This one book is through 1983. This one is through 1999, so are you still a member?
Yes.
But you haven't really been active.
Well, I have not been involved in it because there's more things happening now, and they all have been trying to learn more about the habits of the quail and things, and we have been busy in our business, and I just haven't been involved in it as much as the ordinary people that are in it, which are people that own those places that are wealthy and have money to spend on it, and they're sort of in a position to spend more money on something like that than we were.
Right. Now, you mentioned that Kinderloo, the family, the land, was wiregrass and longleaf land, which has a distinctive habitat and has certain types of animals and plants and birds. You wouldn't necessarily, as a youngster, you might have been hunting in a longleaf forest, or you might not, right, in terms of what when you were hunting with your dad, just growing up as a boy.
No, we hunted in all kind of conditions then. We hunted in oak woods with acorns, and acorns were prolific some years, and that was a better quail shooting land. And we went out to kill the limit. We never did hardly exceed the legal limits. We didn't believe in that. We thought that we'd always make our limit a little lower than the state limits. So we enjoyed that, and we didn't have as much time to hunt as some people. But we hunted when we could.
And the dogs that you're raising now, in the kennel, is this a continuation in some way? I know you said your father had dogs. Are there any bloodlines or anything that are still continuing?
Yes, we had dogs, and we would keep that bloodline. If a dog was easy to handle and good retriever and had a good nose, we found out a good bit about it. And we loved it, and we kept our bloodlines the best we could.
I was wondering if any of the bloodlines go back to some of the dogs. You and your father started to raise these dogs together then? Is this something you did?
I would say that's right.
So you might have dogs today that bloodlines go back?
Yeah, we've got dogs that go back. But always, you know, something will happen one way or the other, and then we go off and breed with somebody else's dog. We want to change it a little bit. Our dogs are really not doing like we wanted to do and wasn't handling right. And some of our neighbors, and they were always friendly. We bred our dogs with other dogs. And I guess that was one of the factors entered into the Georgia Florida Field Trial Association. So some of them had very good, easy handling dogs. But ordinarily, the next year there'd be some other dog that'd win.
Does they always take place on a different property each year, or is it the same place?
Where always, they usually. Now, some of the places were more friendly, and they were laid out in such a way that it was more of a pleasure to hunt them than somebody else's that had it across the highways and all.
Right.
Or something like that, but that worked out. So most of the time we changed from one plantation to the next plantation. But every 10 years they might go back to make that route.
Do you remember where it was the year you won?
Over in the Albany section.
Has it ever been in Kinderlow?
Never have. We felt like we'd be in the Far East, and then we didn't have it as fancy as some of our neighbors did, and so most of them are held in the Thomasville area.
Do you?
If you go there and you drive down the road from Thomasville to Tallahassee, you'll see those plantations.
Right. Did you? You mentioned in Kinderlew, are you farm raising quail, or are you trying to do you have native quail species still on your property?
We have native quail, and we try to plant feed, and we try to listen to our extension service, and we try to plant different feed, and we've trial and error method. So we still do that to some extent, but I would say it's not as great as it was about the time when we won the field trial, because it's expensive to get ready for and expensive to plan all these feeds, and we're not doing quite a good job because we were entertaining some of our business acquaintances, and. Right now, that most of the younger members of some of the companies that we were doing business with are not as interested in quail shooting as they are in golf now. They're different. They're different people.
Is that why you're building the golf course?
No, not necessarily, because we thought that was the best use for that land.
I see. When you take business clients to Kinderlew, what sort of means are you using? Are you using the hunt wagons or horses?
We have wagons with mules, and they come and they'll bring the wives, and we'll hunt in the morning, and then we'll have lunch in the woods. And they're from big cities, and they just never been in the woods, and they really enjoy that. We had some of our customers that would just look forward to coming down and being in the woods for 2 days. And we enjoyed being with them.
What sort of things do they get served in the woods? Is there a meal that you typically have?
We'd have a meal of fried chicken, and then we would have slaw, and we'd have some vegetables, and then we would have my wife would always make brownies, and she loved doing that, and we'd give them that, and then we would have, usually we would have iced tea and coffee to drink, and we were, so everybody liked that sort of picnic style. We had pimento cheese sandwiches. And they really enjoyed that. They knew what they were going to have to eat before they got here.
What sort of staff do you have at Kinderlew in terms of the?
Very small. We've got farmers, and we've had we have two or three farmers there, and then we work with other people on some of our farms out there, and we have very few people, and we really don't have anybody, and that's another thing that really discourages, because. It's very difficult to get people to stay with you as house people and all that. All of these people are over in the Thomasville area that come down here and either retired or they do it in the wintertime. It's very expensive the way they do it, so we couldn't be competitive about that. So we did it on the common Georgia sort of way of doing it. And they like that all right.
But you mentioned you have a cook?
We'd have some of it catered, and we would have somebody doing it all the time. We might pick it up in Valdosta and have somebody bring us the fried chicken and all that. And we quit the business of trying to do it out in the woods, because then that got to be too burdensome.
And what about the drivers for the hunt wagons? Are they employees?
Well, we have had some mighty good ones through the years, and we use to pick up what we can get, but it's very difficult to get without it being very expensive, somebody to stay with you that would do that. But we look after our animals, we look after our dogs, and we look after our mules and our horses.
You mentioned before we had the cameras rolling that you now have a Mexican fellow who's your dog
yeah,
trainer.
We have him. He's an ordained preacher. And he's very good, and he loves dogs, and he came, and he was here in Valdosta, and he was one of the members of the Hispanic church out at Owsley, which is just down the road from Kinderloo. And so, but he has been in it from time to time, and he just decided that he's likes to do that, and he knows that's a job that's not busy all the time, and he likes that job, and so that's who we've got now, is Jose Rodriguez.
And where is he from originally, do you know?
He's from northern Mexico, down there, different places, and we've got two or three families there that help on the farm, and then we doing other things for us that we need to, as forestry work even really.
Mm-hmm.
It's very difficult to get any other kind of labor now.
And so that, previously you would have had non-Mexican labor, I presume, and this is a change to in the last,
yes.
What, 15, 20 years where you?
I guess that's right.
How long would you say that you've had Mexican labor working in Kinderloo?
Partially, I guess it started about 15 or 18 years ago, and then I'd say 10 or 12 years ago has been pretty constant. And we used to have plenty of black labor that had worked out there in old-timey farmers that we could get. When we, my wife and I moved to Kinderloo in 1955. And we had black labor. And now most of the black labor from that area had moved to town. And why, I do not know, but they passed on. And then the young ones coming along don't want to farm. And we have to make enough to pay our expenses and all farming.
How large a property is it?
How
large?
Well, we farm a total everywhere, a little less than 3,000 acres. But that's different. That's done with farmers on a partnership arrangement. And out at Kinderloo, I would say we have a total of about 1,000 acres in cultivation and pasture land, improved pasture.
And does that include just the forest?
Well, no. We have about 10,000 acres that we try to plant feed for quail and all, and we do most of our hunting on.
So you're managing Kinderloo as a wiregrass ecosystem, at least the forested parts of it, is that right?
We're trying to grow the maximum amount of longleaf pine, and we think that's a natural longleaf pine. And longleaf pine is very desirable in our business because it's usually straight, it's usually tapered correctly, and makes good poles, pressure-treated poles. Not large ones. Those have to come from somewhere else or whatever. But we're trying to grow the maximum amount of wood per acre per year.
So Kinderloo is not really a hunting preserve in the sense that you're trying
like,
to keep it.
That's
like
right.
You're still harvesting the timber on
yes,
it.
Yes, ma'am. And using it as a working forest. Now, not like over at Thomasville. We're cutting some timber from a place over there that just lets that timber grow until it gets the bigger poles and select, and they selling quality materials like that that most people couldn't keep a tree that long.
I was wondering, there's one other piece on the table here. It's a certificate from Valtech from 1996 on habitat management for the wild turkey. Is that related to to work you're doing on your own property?
Well, it is, because we tried everything in the world to get stock that we could grow wild turkeys. We didn't have them in the woods. And my father was very anxious, and he tried to get them, you know, but say, well, we've got pen raised, but it's from the real live stock. But we found out that kind of stock didn't know how to take care of themselves. And other vomit animals would just catch them, and that would be the end of that. But finally, he was on the Fish and Game Department, and they found out how Alabama was doing, some other states. They were catching the real wild turkeys and putting them on an island or some place where they could re-catch them. And it's been unbelievable how many wild turkeys that we have in our area now. A lot of people don't know how to hunt them and all that, but they are very smart birds. And it's a very good hunting, and it's pretty to see in the woods, and we have done all we could do. But we get a great kick out of having deer on our property. We didn't have any deer at first, and they brought deer, Fish and Game Commission there, brought deer from Wisconsin to South Georgia, from Macon South, because we had gotten rid of the screwworm that were on cattle and animals and all, and we couldn't have done it before. And I brought them down, and they have really expanded, and now they're getting so many and they're about becoming a nuisance. But it's a great sport.
Just going to say, I forgot to mention this, the wild turkey habitat management plaque is ID number 72. And let me just make sure I understood what you told me. So the wild turkey that you have in Kinderloo, for example, is brought in from Alabama?
No. They're brought in from places in Georgia. Say maybe Jekyll Island, maybe the Cumberland Island.
But islands.
Yeah. No, we don't get anything from any other state. And they'd bring us what they catch and throw the net over them. And they'd get along fine, and they would lay and hatch, and those that they look after themselves. There sure is a difference between a pen-raised turkey and one that's a real wild stock.
So this is part of an organized effort by Fish and Game in Georgia to reintroduce wild turkeys, and this certificate was just part of a training you had about
how to feed for them and all that. Yes.
So is that common here in South Georgia now, or are you one of the few?
Oh, there's a million deer in Georgia
now.
No,
the turkeys.
Turkeys? Oh, I don't know. There's more turkeys than there are deer. I don't really know, and I haven't heard any figure. Because they're animals, they don't really bother anything. Like deer will come up to your house and eat your shrubbery at night, you know. But the turkeys, they're careful, very careful. And the eyes, I don't know how they see so well. They can't smell like a deer can, but a turkey will spot you quicker than a deer.
So are you still going out and hunting?
Some, but not as much as I did. And it's a little more difficult, and we haven't been as particular about it here in recent years. And while our business was expanding and my time was needed, and I've been not spending the time I would like to have.
Well, you're an unusual man. Usually someone who gets to be of a certain age spends more time with some of their hobbies, and you're involved more in your business and keeping up with all the changes.
I enjoy seeing what we're doing and the progress we're making, and trying to make other things out of wood, and trying to make the management of trees profitable. That's fascinating.
Okay, well, I think we've gotten through our box of odds and ends here. Is anything you want to add?
No. I thought the best thing to do, we've got some more stuff, and I want to get that, but the things that know that we're not going to be using and want to keep. I'll see if that, but I don't think it'll be. We'll cut that down and then we'll see. So I appreciate what you're
doing. I don't mean add in terms of stuff, but I mean add in terms of what we've talked about today.
I don't think so. Okay. I don't think you. I think you've covered it very well.
Well, thank you. All right, so this will complete the third interview with Mr. Harley. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Doctor.
I got to go through and listen to all those things again and extract all your words of wisdom.